So now I want to take you to an article by a man called Glasser in Theological Studies 1971, where he contrasts two things which we need to be very aware of, and it's not that obvious. On the left-hand side is what the psychologists call the superego, the tapes that go around in your head because of what mum told you, dad told you, sister Ildefonsus told you, and brother Erasmus told you, and the uncle told you, and the priest told you. Do you get me? The tapes that are going around there that we act on as children, and as adults they're still playing. On the right-hand side is conscience, which I've been talking about all night. Let's look at the difference that he suggests and see what sense you can make of it. The superego commands that an act be performed for approval in order to make oneself lovable, accepted. The basis of the superego is fear of love being withdrawn if I don't behave in this certain way. A lot to reflect on here. You've got later to do it when you pick it off the web. Conscience, on the contrary, invites to action, invites to love, and in this very act of other-directed commitment, it invites us to co-create self-value, who I am, without fear of who you might like or mightn't like, discovering of the self. A lot to ponder. Second point that he suggests for our reflection, the superego is introverted. The thematic center is a sense of one's own value. Am I valuable? What's the word they use? Self-image and self-esteem. Conscience is extroverted. The thematic center is the value which invites. That would be a good thing to do. Self-value is secondary. You do it because it's to be done and it's a good thing to do. And later on when you reflect on it, you might think, gee, I'm glad I did that. It took a lot of courage and you'll get a certain sense of self-value. But you don't do it for that reason. You do it because it's to be done. Third point. The superego is static. It doesn't grow. It doesn't learn. It can't function creatively in a new situation because the tape is an old tape. It merely repeats a basic command, and you feel dreadful if you don't do it, so you do it. Conscience is dynamic. It's an awareness and sensitivity to value. It develops as you mature, it grows. A mindset that can function with precision in a totally new situation that there's no tapes for because you've learned to be caring, loving, gentle. The values are there. So you respond beautifully. No one's telling you what to do, but you've conscience has guided you to a maturity. Okay? 3 pages of this. And you'll need to reflect on it later quietly, of course. The superego is authority figure oriented. It might still be your mother who's 92 who's running your life. It might still be your husband or your wife or your daughter or whatever. It's an authority figure oriented. It's not a question of perceiving and responding to a value, but of obeying blindly the command of authority. Whoever you give authority to. Conscience is value-oriented. The value or disvalue, the negative, is perceived and responded to regardless of whether the authority is commanded or not. I think that's a fairly obvious one. Superego is, his word is, atomized. Quite good. Units of activity are its object, and they're all atomized, meaning disjointed. This, they may not be consistent, but that's the good, yeah, better do that, or mum might be pleased, or my wife will, whatever, or my husband will. So do that, and then do that, and do that, and do that. But they don't form a pattern, whereas conscience is individual acts are seen in their importance as part of a larger process or pattern. It's a bigger picture you're working in. The superego is past-oriented, primarily concerned with cleaning up the record with regard to past acts. Go to confession, whatever. Get the past all cleared so that you're right now. Listen, these aren't bad. None of this is bad or good. We're just looking at the different. So getting the past all cleared up is really, really important. He says, I'm not too sure about this, but conscience is future-oriented. I actually think it's present-oriented myself, but anyhow, he says future-oriented. In this sense, it's creative. He sees the past as having a future and helping to structure this so to have a better future. It's about where I'm going, but I think it's actually about where I am. But anyhow, I'll let you ponder that for yourself later. The superego, there's an urge to be punished and thereby to earn reconciliation. This is quite subtle, and I'm not sure of it all, but you can ponder it. To be punished, it's all over then. It's all solved because you've suffered the punishment, and then you can earn the reconciliation with the person. Conscience sees the need to repair. We're not blind to the past, and we're not saying, as some politicians seem to want to say, we've got to move on. You know, we look at the past the way. Yeah. So there's a need to repair by structuring the future orientation today and tomorrow toward the value in question, which includes making past harms good, doing what we can to fix it up. But it's all about what can we do now? We can't actually undo the past, but is there something we can do now to mend it, to reconcile, to love rather than, you know, it's geared to the reality of the present moment, which keeps moving. And to conclude his contrast, and I'm obviously aware this is something for a lot of reflection on your own part. The superego, he suggests, there's a rapid transition from severe isolation and guilt feelings, etc., to a sense of self-value accomplished by confessing to an authority figure. Confession is a place that can, where this used to be able to happen, and I don't want to say it's bad, but just reflect on it. So you've done this and this and this, you go to confession, great, oh, it's all over, you're back, you're innocent again, fantastic. And tomorrow you're back at it again, maybe. Like you haven't learnt anything, but you've cleared it away and you've been given absolution, so it's all forgiven. But nothing's been learned and nothing's really been healed. It's just a security got through that. Whereas conscience is a sense of the gradual process of growth which characterises all dimensions of genuine personal development. So you're learning all the time and putting things in place and, you know, whatever. Superego. It's possible with the superego, the tapes, great disproportion between guilt experienced and the value in question. As a child, you were told to come to go to Mass on Sunday, every Sunday, and I've got to be sensitive about all this trying to be, and I'm not talking, obviously, but let's imagine that's how I was. And a person comes to me, people do come to me, and they say, I didn't go to Mass on Sunday. And I ask why. Their mother was dying. They were all day in hospital with her. They cared for a neighbour. They had to cook a meal for the person next door. They've lived a heroic Sunday, but they didn't actually go to Mass. Are you with me? And they're beautiful people, and of course we all treat each other with the greatest respect, and it's all lovely, and there's nothing wrong with what I'm saying. But what I mean is they need reassurance that there's no sin there. Do you get me? There's no sin there. And of course there's no sin there. But the tape is still there. So there's a big disproportion between the way they're feeling anxious and what they've done. So it's an immaturity, and we've all got immaturity till the day we die. So the extent of guilt depends more on the weight of an authority figure and the volume with which he speaks rather than the value in question. Dad insisted on this, and he was, you know. So you're still doing it at 60 because of this massive thing that was just so important to you, but it's actually quite childish. And conscience is an experience of guilt, and there's a Butte thing called guilt. And if you don't have any guilt, God help you. Your conscience must be absolutely dead. So guilt is a good thing when it's appropriate. It's proportionate to the importance of the value in question, even though authority may never have addressed the issue before. So there's no tapes about it, but you think, oh, I shouldn't have done that, or you know, whatever. So to conclude, he says, too much theory and practice in the church, in his opinion, arises from data whose source is the superego, not the conscience. Many problems can be traced to a failure to recognize the nature, presence, and power of the superego. Many people have never actually thought of looking at to these, you may be among them, but have a good look, and you know, once you see it, it becomes clear the difference between the superego, which feels like conscience, and conscience. This is a situation which can be overcome and should no longer be tolerated. So now we draw to a conclusion. The last work, last major writing of Newman, a wonderful theologian of the 19th century, many say the greatest theologian of the 19th century, is a letter to the Duke of Norfolk. And in that he has this to say. The sense of right and wrong, which is the first element in religion, is so delicate, so fitful, so easily puzzled, obscured, perverted, so subtle in its argumentative methods, so impressible by education, so biased by pride and passion, so unsteady in its course, that in the struggle for existence amid the various exercises and triumphs of the human intellect, this sense, the sense of right and wrong, is at once the highest of all teachers, yet the least luminous. And the church, the pope, the hierarchy, are, in the divine purpose, to supply an urgent demand. A beautiful statement for us as those of you who are Catholic, Christian. We've got this enormous gift to be read carefully, to be understood theologically and all that. But to know, to take the advantage of my life and because I've got nothing else to do, well, to have read St. Augustine and to have read St. Basil in the East and to have read all the church documents of the councils of the church, to have read the mystics, to have read the Thomas Aquinas, which we studied for Blumen 7 years in the seminary, you know what I mean? To have read Rana and to have read Newman and to have, in my youth, to be brought up on it, can't you see what an incredible gift that is to me? Because you've got holiness at all these levels, pointing in directions of value and behaviour, which is absolutely consistent. There's slight variations, but it's all there as a gift. And, well, I don't have to prove it to you, do I? But what a help! And to know none of that, and to be in life, trying, as he says, to do right and wrong, But without much help except from your mates and SMSing your girlfriends and boyfriends to find out what they think, if they think, but you know, what they think, if that's your only, you see the difference surely. What a gift it is to have this magisterium there, as long as it's humble and truthful and careful and all of that stuff we're saying, and as long as we... But what a gift it is to us, and that's what he's saying. As an old man, 80-something he was when he wrote this, and he's writing his last to this Duke of Norfolk, who's a Catholic layman. Vatican II... Declaration on Religious Freedom. Informing their consciences, the faithful must pay careful attention to the sacred and certain teaching of the Church. Certain teaching of the Church. For the Catholic Church is by the will of Christ the teacher of truth. It is her duty to proclaim and teach with authority the truth which is Christ, and at the same time to declare and confirm by her authority the principles of the moral order which spring from human nature itself. That needs a lot of care, but there is a lovely truth in it for us who have the privilege of belonging to such a wise community. Okay, so there, that's just an offering there. But all truth, anything the Church says, when you listen to it, go to the foot of the cross, watch Jesus dying for you in love, and read it there. Don't, if you read anywhere else, you get it wrong. Don't let Jesus out of your sight when you read a church document, because it's all about pointing to him. And it'll all be very safe if you're looking at him. Cosgrave again, man I quoted earlier in his book and his article, What is Conscience in that Doctrine and Life, says this: while numbers do not and cannot make an action right or wrong, they can and do indicate the degree of acceptance or rejection of a specific teaching receives among the people to whom it's directed. General acceptance shows a general perception of the truth and reasonableness of the teaching. Widespread rejection indicates a failure to perceive the truth and the reasonableness of it. And yes, there's things already in the Church today that might appear to you and me and many people as not that reasonable, not presented, you know, and we question it. And when you find really good people, when I talk to all my, I will speak in general for obvious reasons at the moment, but when I'm talking to priests that I love and respect and are in touch, and we all find ourselves with the same uncomfortable feeling about a church's position, and we're not proudly saying it's wrong, but you know what I mean? There's a reason for hesitation in the matter. And when my mother and father and brothers and sisters and you and people who are living a Christian life are just not persuaded, well, then we need to look at it. And he says, in the latter case, when a widespread rejection or non-acceptance of a teaching is there, it will be incumbent, this is very important, on the teaching authority. They've got two things they better do. One is either present more convincing case for the teaching, which can be seen to be reasonable. And we think, oh, I see, I hadn't thought of that. And we think, oh, yeah, now that you put it that way, yeah, I see. And we discuss it and we think, yeah, that's really important. Either they do that, so that more and ideally all can see the truth and its reasonableness and accept it. That's one possibility. The second, says Cosgrave, if this is not possible, then the authority should undertake the painful task of re-examining the official teaching so as to arrive at and proclaim a different position whose truth and reasonableness can be made evident by convincing arguments. You accept either of those, eh? Now, in the church to which I belong, which I absolutely love, and I'm never tempted to be anywhere else, there's not a long history. Pope John Paul II did a bit of it, apologising about Galileo and so on, but there's a long history of Pope saying, as our esteemed, whatever the person said, and they quote each other down the centuries, But when things change, silence dominates, I think. And they don't say, well, we used to say that, but now we've seen through it and we say this. Because they're a bit afraid that that would lose authority, or people might think, oh, if they're wrong then, they could be wrong now. Well, of course, if they're wrong then, they could be wrong now. But there's a bit of a, well, in my view, we're treated like children. And they don't realise the joy you get when Pope John Paul II says, we got it wrong about Galileo and we're sorry. We got it wrong about Luther. Some of the things Luther said weren't right, of course, but we got it wrong about that, and we, you know, that makes me love the church more, and I bet it does it for you too. And I love people who can say they're wrong, because then I know when they don't say they're wrong, they might be right, because they're looking for the truth. So that's what he's saying. Now, this is not merely desirable, it's obligatory on church teaching authorities. If it's not done, only harm can come to the community in the form of uncertainty, confusion, disagreement and conflict, and perhaps worst of all, the gradual erosion of the teaching authority of the church. And if church leaders in any part of our, let's talk about the Catholic Church in some way, if church leaders there say things that are clearly stupid and then say something else that's clearly stupid, and I'm being a bit heavy, but it is clearly stupid, are you going to read what they say tomorrow? But tomorrow they may say something incredibly wise, but you've lost it. They're not on your favourites or your whatever you put in your computer. They're not there anymore because they've gone off the screen because you can't trust them because of what they've done or what the priest says from the pulpit. Well, you go to another church for God's sake, or check that Mark is saying the Mass and I'm not, you know, just to avoid another homily from me. So, no, I presume that's what you do. It seems to be going like that way. No one seems to turn up when I'm on to giving the homily. No, so it's, but I mean, we do make choices like that. So trust requires that when we're certain, we're certain, with humility. When we think it's probable, we say, look, it's probable, but I'm not really quite certain, and people can accept that. Or we say it's possibly this, but there are different opinions on this. Then everyone's happy with that. And no one minds someone saying, I don't know. Pope John Paul I, best example I've had of this, and he wasn't there for many days, was it 42 days he was Pope? Dear man, that beautiful smile of his. And I still remember this occasion and with the joy that it gave me. It was the first, if my memory is correct, you know, memory does tricks over you because I'm going back a long time, however many years that is, 30 years or something or more. So someone shoved a microphone in front of him because it was the first, I think it was in England, baby that was born from in vitro fertilisation or something, first one in a test tube kind of thing. And they shoved this microphone, modern world, and the Pope was there, and they said, what do you think about it? And the dear man said, I want to congratulate his parents. I thought, you beautiful man. Like, he didn't go to somebody, I want to congratulate the parents. And then he said, oh, you're probably interested in the moral implications of all this. He said, well, I'm not really up on all that. And I thought, I'd listen to a Pope. And I got such joy. Because how could he be up on it all? He said, it will need investigation, we'll need to talk it through, there's a lot of complexities, and in time that'll happen, but I wished them well, and, you know. And I stopped that interview thinking, I've never heard anything better from a Pope in my whole life. And I bet you'd feel the same. So what's the problem with authority being humble and real? None. And most of it is like that. John Henry Newman had the last say. This was something he said. Certain difficulties felt by Anglicans is what he wrote about. As you know, he was an Anglican. He was a chaplain at Oxford University, and through intellectual persuasion, he got to a point where he became a Catholic, took another step into this church. But he knew how hard it could be for an Anglican to join the church. And this is one of the things he had to say in it. Conscience, he said, is the voice of God. Conscience is not a judgment upon any speculative truth, abstract, an abstract doctrine. But it bears immediately on conduct, on something to be done or not to be done. We've been saying that all night. Hence, conscience cannot come into direct collision with the church's or the Pope's infallibility, which is engaged on general propositions and in the condemnation of particular and given errors. One's about what to do, the other is about truth in general terms. Next, he says, I observe that conscience, this is all very important, conscience being a practical dictate, what is the next step of love for me to take in this situation? That's my bit. Collision is possible between it and the Pope's authority only when the Pope legislates or gives particular orders and the like. But a Pope is not infallible in his laws, nor in his commands, nor in his acts of state, nor in his administration, nor in his public policy. None of that is where infallibility lies. So you could be wrong. If you're not infallible, you're fallible. If you're fallible, you could be wrong. So you're not bound by it in your conscience. Are you with me? So he continues, if conscience is to prevail against the voice of the Pope, it must follow upon serious thought, prayer, and all available means of arriving at a right judgment on the matter in question. The onus of proof is on the conscience. If I've got very authoritative statements telling me one thing, I ought to presume that they know more than I do. Do you know what I mean? As a beginning point, I better be humble, and I better be wary of my own biases and not think I know more than the Pope or the Vatican or the whatever it might be, or the General Council of the Church. So let's be humble about this. But humble doesn't mean I don't know anything, and humble doesn't mean I do what they say. Humble means I listen attentively, but I also am the only one in touch with this situation right now, so I still must make a decision according to my best judgment. So back to Newman. The onus of proof is on conscience. Unless a person is able to say to himself or herself in the presence of God that he mustn't and dare not act upon the injunction of the Pope, he is bound to obey it. And that concludes, just give me a minute, concludes this.